Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 13th of December, a cold day all over Wisconsin. And I know many of you had so much snow over the weekend. We were lucky in Milwaukee. It's cold, though. I'm doing my interviews this morning with my winter jacket on in the studio. It's just kind of cold, but it's okay. We'll get through it all, and the butterflies will be here again if we plant the milkweed. So here we go. It's all things political, and there's a lot to talk about. We have as our guest the woman who wrote the cover story for this week's issue of Time magazine. It's on Sarah Palin, and we will get to Sarah Palin, probably not at the top of the show, but it's a very interesting article. Palin and Progress, does she want to be president or just rich and famous? Our guest is Jay Newton Small, the congressional correspondent for Time. She spent time as a young person growing up in Asia, Australia, and Europe. Her parents were vagabond United Nations parents. She's a graduate of Tufts and Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, previously covered politics for Bloomberg News. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Of course, we've got the Senate voting today. This looks like this compromise legislation on tax cuts will pass the hurdle, and we'll talk about that. We'll look at Bernie Sanders' filibuster. We'll be talking about the changes that may happen in this tax cut plan, if there will be any last-minute changes. The nuclear arms treaty, that could come up in Congress later this week. And whatever else you would like to discuss. It's all things political, so put whatever you would like to on the agenda. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you would care to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Jay. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, great pleasure to have you here. We'll hold off on Sarah Palin. We'll get to her in just a little while. But let's look at what's going on today. Is this compromise on tax cut legislation going to pass the Senate today?
Well, it's expected to get what they call cloture, which is a vote to limit the debate to 30 hours. It's most often the most difficult hurdle in passing legislation. But final passage will probably happen within the next 2 or 3 days.
And will the Democrats be tweaking the legislation at all? Will they be able to do that?
Well, once you get cloture, you can tweak a little bit, but mostly it has to pretty much stay the way it is. And I think right now, although there's an enormous amount of unhappiness in the House, the Senate is pretty happy with the deal the way it is, and it looks like they have, you know, enough votes to pass it. But the House is going to be interesting because there's a threat that they're going to change the estate tax provision. There's a provision in it which says that any estates, when you die, that are worth more than $3.5 million would be taxed at a rate of 35%. Right now, as it stands, the estate tax is sort of non-existent this year, and then next year it snaps back to its original levels of $5 million and 50%. So this is a provision that Republicans very much want in the bill, but it's one that Democrats say is far too generous to the rich, especially, and there's word that the House Democrats are going to try and change that provision when they pass the bill later this week, which would force the Senate to then come back in and then repass their version if they can, which we're not sure that they have the votes to do so. And it might end up ping-ponging back and forth between the two chambers over the next week or so.
I see. And so refresh my memory on how this bill, so the Democrats in the House perhaps decide to go ahead with that change in the estate tax. It goes back to the Senate. They don't have the votes. Then what?
Well, I think what will happen and what I'm told has happened is the Senate will pass the same exact thing that they have already passed.
Right.
Send it back to the House and basically say, I'm sorry, but you're just going to have to eat this. You're just going to have to take the pain, suffer, and pass it. Otherwise, you're going to have to, it'll bring down the entire agenda. So it's a bit of playing hardball on both sides. And you know, it may not come to that. It may just be that the House Democrats fail to get enough votes to change the estate tax provision. But that is their plan, as I understand it right now.
So if they did get enough votes and they held fast on this, then the whole thing would fall apart?
excuse me about that. I don't know. I mean, I don't think the whole thing is going to fall apart. And I think that, you know, there is certainly an awareness amongst House Democrats that this is, you know, the president's agenda, that if you don't pass this at some point, you will weaken the president who's up for re-election and whose coattails all of them are hoping to ride in 2012. So while I think one round of sort of changing it and sending it back to the Senate and sort of sends in the message that they're incredibly unhappy and they're not always going to go along with what he wants, I think in the end, two rounds of that or bringing down the entire bill is just not in the interest of the Democratic Party.
We've heard so many members of the House particularly say that they really felt left out of the process, Jay. They were not consulted. They are the Congress, after all, and the president was negotiating with Republicans instead of negotiating with people in the House. Is there merit in that?
There certainly is. The Senate, the deal was worked out essentially between the Vice President's Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, Jean Sperling, and Mitch McConnell. It was worked out even without the participation of Senate Democrats, and Senate Democrats were extremely unhappy about this as well. And so to say that the House Democrats felt left out, absolutely. I mean, they weren't consulted about this. They weren't asked if they would be willing to pass this. It was really sort of, let's have a deal, and then afterwards we just expect you to sort of come along and back the president because you're all part of the same party.
Well, why would the administration operate that way?
I think part of it was calculated. You know, the deal is actually a good one for the president. You know, it creates this massive second stimulus. It's much needed money in terms of tax relief, in terms of unemployment insurance, and all kinds of other things that are in this bill it's I think $900 billion worth of goodies for voters out there. So it's a win for the president. But it also is a win for Republicans, and I think that Democrats don't like the idea of working in a bipartisan way to a certain degree of giving Republicans of yielding to their demands, and they feel that they have the votes in the Senate still, they have the votes in the House still. It's the lame duck. It's not the new session hasn't started yet. Why should they bow to these Republican demands?
It does seem that some of these Democrats have a bit of a point. So walk me through this, please. We're living through a very difficult time. A lot of people, as you know, don't have jobs or they're not seeing their paychecks go up. And we're seeing those who have a lot in this country continue to have a lot. And we've bailed out people who created a financial mess for many of us. People lost their pensions. There's not as much anger, really, in this country as I thought that there would be. But when you're looking at people really hurting and then some people still making a whole lot of money, it's understandable to me why some Democrats, based on the principles of their party, would kind of hold fast on this, that this is a time to give to the least among us. The best, those who are doing the best among us are doing just fine.
Yes, but I mean, overall, the impact of this bill is beneficial for everybody, for not just the rich, but also the middle class and the sort of less wealthy, I guess, those beneath the poverty line. It's estimated by many economists that without passage of this bill, you know, unemployment would remain at about 9.8-9.9% by the 2012 election. With passage of this bill, it's now expected to go down to about 8.5. So if you're looking at 8.5%, I mean, that's millions, I think, at least several hundred thousand jobs that will be created because of this legislation. And I think that's an important thing to look at as well. It's not just that while the argument is over these provisions that will help the rich, it is a much larger bill that will essentially help everybody.
But we've already had these tax provisions in place for some time. How have they helped the economy?
Well, it's impossible to say, you know, how it's helped the economy. I mean, it puts more money back into voters' pockets or to all taxpayers' pockets. And so in that sense, theoretically, you know, it should go to being spent out there, buying more Christmas gifts, buying, you know, whatever it is you spend your extra anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000 on. It could go to paying off saving, credit card debt, that kind of thing. So just having more money out there that people spend versus more money that goes into the government's pocket is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. The president had a press conference, a very unusual press conference at the end of last week when Bill Clinton came into the room. President Clinton and President Obama said that he had to meet his wife. He was late for an appointment, and he turned the press conference over to President Clinton. Kind of unusual, wasn't it?
It was. And for anybody, I mean, I never covered the Clinton White House. I covered the Bush White House. But when I was a White House correspondent, there was always these stories of Bill Clinton and how he would just love to talk and sort of would almost filibuster when he, you know, with the press. And on the airplane, for example, on Air Force One, they would be, like, begging him to go to sleep. And he'd be like, but wait, let's hang out. Let's talk some more. So to kind of hand over your entire podium in your press room to President Clinton is an amazingly risky thing because there was potential for him to be there for hours just because he loves to take questions. He loves to engage. And it really was a remarkable moment between the two of them, and I think one that shows that they've come a long way in their relationship that was pretty antagonistic back in the early days of the primaries of 2007, 2008.
Why do you think President Obama turned over the podium?
I think part of it was, I mean, it was very impromptu. Most of the staff were upstairs having a Christmas party. And, you know, I think Robert Gibbs was called down, and basically the two of them had been sitting in the Oval Office. And, you know, and Obama basically said, wow, you've got some really great thoughts on this tax debate. I like the way you're phrasing things. Why don't you talk to the press about this? And Clinton was sort of like, oh, sure, that would be great. And it was very impromptu. And I think if you had planned it out, it wouldn't have been as insightful, as impactful as it was, just because, you know, they wouldn't have been quite so, you know, off the cuff, just not scripted, which is so rare to see in a White House. I mean, everything in the White House is scripted. Every moment is planned out. So to see something like this is really unusual and refreshing.
It was interesting to watch Clinton because it was, at least to my eyes, as though he had never left.
Yeah. He definitely, it was at this moment, it was sort of like deja vu. You just felt
right.
Like it was all over again back in the 90s. And I think that was an image perhaps they're also trying to portray, was like looking back at that time when the economy was great and everybody had surpluses and we had a balanced budget. And here he is, you know, Bill Clinton back at the podium. It just felt really, it was a funny feeling.
Yeah. How much of an impact did Bernie Sanders' filibuster make in Washington? Were people listening to it? Were they upset about what he had to say? Were there a lot of Democrats who were happy about it?
Well, certainly I think there were a lot of Democrats that were happy about it. They were, you know, sort of encouraging him and helping him and saying, go, Bernie. And because I think he certainly was putting a voice and a face to a lot of Democratic anger that existed out there. I mean, obviously, the filibuster ended, and he won't have any impact on whether or not the legislation will pass the Senate. But he certainly represented, for a lot of Democrats, both Senate and Republican, the face of the anger at the president and the anger at this deal and feeling that they've been undermined. So, and it was just great to see something like that, an old-fashioned sort of filibuster, because you never get that anymore. You never really get people passionate enough to sort of take the floor and run with it. So that also was really fun to see.
So have we seen the end of those kinds of filibusters on this bill?
I think the Senate is pretty well. I mean, they're expecting a cloture vote this afternoon, and I think they pretty much have the vote. So I don't know. I don't think you will see a filibuster on it. No, I think they have the votes, and the debate will be limited to 30 hours, if not less, and then they'll pass it.
Let's go to Sarah Palin for a moment before, and we can talk more about her during the hour before we go to our phone calls, because we have a lot of people who want to talk to you. So we'll be with them in a moment. Sarah Palin, since you wrote in the piece, the most intriguing thing Palin has done since 2008 is march steadily to the right. Once a moderate Republican who appealed to Alaska's independent voters, she is now much more overtly conservative. How so and why?
Well, you have to remember back when John McCain picked her as his running mate, she had an approval rating in Alaska of 80%. And she did that by essentially, when she ran for governor, splitting the Republican Party. She ran against Frank Murkowski, who was a very powerful Alaska Republican, and she essentially did a very similar playbook to what I think she's doing now, and that is she abruptly resigned her position as chairman of the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which is essentially an incredibly powerful board in Alaska that controls all oil and gas development, and in protest, saying that this is, you know, a very corrupt process. And when she did it, everybody was shocked. You know, like they basically said, this is political suicide. I can't believe that you are, you know, resigning this commission. And she did so And then she essentially went on the campaign trail around Alaska, talking about how corrupt Juneau is, talking about how the system doesn't work. And this is, again, against a Republican governor, the sitting Republican governor, that she's doing this. She drummed up all this, you know, anticipation that, you know, that she became essentially the whistleblower. She was the person who was going to clean out the old boys club in the establishment Republicans in Juneau. And, you know, everyone was wondering, is she going to run for governor? At the last possible minute, she entered into the gubernatorial race and just swept to victory, and that's how she won. But she always had a base of Democrats, independents, and some Republicans, about half the Republican Party, but the other half of the party was incredibly angry at her for taking down Frank Murkowski. So when she came back to Alaska, you know, after she left the vice presidential campaign trail, she really came back to a world that was changed. She'd become incredibly partisan, you know, at McCain's request. He needed essentially a pit bull. He needed an attack dog on the campaign trail, and she became that for him. But she knew it would come at a cost. And so when she went back to Alaska, she'd lost much of her governing coalition. She no longer had the independents. She no longer had the Democrats. And she only had about half still of the Republican Party, which made it impossible for her to pass anything or really to get anything done, which is part of the reason why she resigned her office. But it's been striking that she could have gone back to, you know, trying to make a sort of more bipartisan bent, trying to regain those independents and moderates. And instead, she chose to stay quite to the right, and really, instead of courting the Washington establishment, instead of coming to D.C. and kissing the rings of the party leaders and raising money for them, she chose to go outside of the Washington establishment and into, you know, the heartland of America, and to become essentially the one of the leaders of the Tea Parties. And she spent more time sort of organizing and helping them raise money and looking at Tea Party candidates, and that, I think, was really just an amazingly interesting move for a candidate, you know, unlike other presidential wannabes who follow this extremely predictable path to the nomination. She's done it in a completely insurgent way, and in a way that also, like she did in Alaska, splits the Republican Party, because the establishment is not very fond of her.
Mm-hmm. You had some interesting things to say about Todd's role, her husband's role in orchestrating everything that she's doing right now, and it's a lot.
Yeah, he's kind of an interesting character. I mean, this is a guy who, for, you know, the last 20 years, essentially since they got married in 1988, was the main breadwinner of the family. He was working up in the oil fields of the North Slope. He in the winter and the summer, he was running his commercial fishing business. Now he's handing over that commercial fishing business to their son, Track. He's quit his job in the North Slope with BP, and he's essentially CEO of Palin Inc. I mean, if there's anyone who's her Svengali, it's Todd. And, you know, he makes every decision with her. He preps her for TV appearances. He travels with her. He's Mr. Mom and helps take care of the kids. And I think it's really striking to me. I thought, you know, I didn't realize this until I started researching the story. They don't have a nanny. I mean, they have five kids, and they don't have a nanny. And while, yes, two of them don't live at home, you know, one of them is a special needs toddler. And that's kind of amazing, you know, that they just do it, the two of them. So,
do you think that she's running the risk at all of being a bit overexposed?
You know, that's a fine line, and it's definitely one that, you know, she's going to have to tread very carefully. I think certainly it's, you know, it's striking that this celebrity has become such a big kind of tool, almost, to presidential candidates these days. And much along the lines of Barack Obama, and I covered his campaign, in 2007, 2008. One of his biggest assets as a candidate was the fact that he was essentially a celebrity. I mean, that everybody knew his name. He had name recognition. That he had a sort of loyal following that had already been built in. So, it was really interesting, you know, that she's coming from a very similar place, where she's got this celebrity, she's built this brand over the last year, and now she's sort of making this pivot where she's turning more towards policy. She's writing op-eds for the Wall Street Journal. She's going to Haiti with Franklin Graham. She's planning a trip to England and Israel in the spring and other countries. So she's getting now more serious. She spent the year building her brand. Now she's building up her sort of credentials, you know, to be president.
Do you think she's smart?
Absolutely. I think she is. I think it's a misnomer when people say that she's not smart. I mean, she's clearly very cagey. She made $13 million this year, written books. You know, she's made these political moves that were completely unorthodox, but very successful. So, I mean, I don't think she's the kind of person who's book learned and who reads like briefing books, you know, every night or anything like that. I think she's incredibly, she's got great instincts.
Let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. We're talking with the congressional correspondent for Time Magazine, who did the cover story on Sarah Palin of this week's issue of Time Magazine. She also, as you heard her say, covered Barack Obama's campaign. She is J. Newton Small. And here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Our number two of our program today, Istanbul has been named the world's best performing city in terms of how well they've done at growing their economy. And when we look at the top, I don't, even 20 cities, you will find that the best performing cities are not in the United States. Where are they and why are they elsewhere? Will be the focus of our conversation. We'll be speaking with the senior fellow and research director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. And just a reminder, because everybody needs a laugh, Thursday, 10 o'clock, comedy, mark it down, we're going to laugh. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. J. Newton Small, our guest, and Chris from Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I wanted to talk about these tax breaks. You know, I am shocked that all these millionaires in Congress are giving tax breaks to their millionaire and billionaire selves and friends. It's amazing to me. And they're holding the rest of us hostage for these things. You know, I'm tired of them telling me that, people telling me that if they don't get these tax breaks, they're going to have accountants take them away anyhow. So by that logic, we should just give keys to the banks, to the robbers. And, you know, the next thing that's coming is the way we pay all these things back. Who do you think is going to do the paying back? They're talking about cuts in Social Security, in Medicare, in Medicaid. They already are planning to pay for free and reduced price lunches for poor and hungry children, but by cutting food stamps for their families. Just as an aside, you know, if people are getting $100,000 checks, I'd like one, please. I promise to start a business and hire people. And if you give $100,000 check to my son and his young family, they promise to spend it all.
Jay.
I totally understand your anger at this, and I understand a lot of the Democratic anger. Unfortunately, just the way the Senate functions, there's just no way to do this without Republican support. And get ready, because this is the new future, right? I mean, the expanded majorities in the next session will pretty much ensure that everything that passes from here on in will have to be done with Republican support. And it's going to be a lot more compromising. It's going to be a lot more of deals like this one, which the base and Democratic voters are not going to be very happy with.
Can we talk for just a moment about the deficit? It seems to me as though it's difficult to attack this huge deficit if you're giving these kinds of tax breaks. Is it possible, or is this an issue that will just sort of go by the wayside?
There was a sort of amount of irony watching the Deficit Reduction Commission come out with this recommendation, you know, this report for trillions in cuts to the government and, in fact, tax hikes the same sort of week that you have Congress moving to cut taxes even more, or at least continue the tax cuts that we already have. But to be fair, the Deficit Commission did also say that short-term tax relief is essential to getting the economy back in order. And they did support extending the Bush tax cuts, mostly because they say that, you know, this money is needed to stimulate the economy. And once the economy gets back going again, that engine is sort of roars back to life, then revenues will come back up again to the federal government because people will be paying more in taxes as they are making more money. So there is a need for a certain amount of tax relief in the short term. But yes, in the long term, there is this massive deficit out there, and it's a real problem. And it's a giant sort of, you know, we're all on the train, it's heading towards the cliff, we know it's coming. And we just haven't, you know, we haven't really dealt with it yet. And I find it, you know, it's disheartening that the commission couldn't get enough votes to force, enough support to force a vote in Congress on the recommendations. But as Senator Judd Gregg put it, who is one of the senators on the commission, he said that if you think of it like this, there's a Category 5 hurricane that's about 30 miles off the coast. And what this is our evacuation plan. So we may not be evacuating right now, and we may not be putting this plan into place right now, but at least the plan exists, and we know what to do. And so when we do get to the point where we need to evacuate, we know how to do it.
Let's go to Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Well, first off, just coming out of the box, it seems to me that to accept all of the bad things that are happening in the world is just Uncle Tom foolery, and we have to resist in whatever way we can. As an aside from what I was calling on, the Bernie Sanders was talking about the working poor and this person that's going to be walking 8 miles to and from work every day because they can't afford the price of gas. So I think as a nation, we're better than that, than to put people in this kind of situation. Last night on Anderson Cooper had a special on the Taliban, and there was this fellow who has been covering wars overseas, ranging from the Mujahideen to Bosnia and now the current situation with the Taliban, and he embedded himself with the Taliban for several months, and the impression of the Taliban people were that God was on their side and they would help. God would help them destroy the invader, and they're pursuing their fight with very limited weapons from 25 to 30 years ago and ammunition from 25 to 30 years ago. And even the 12-year-old son of this Taliban leader was involved in carrying a machine gun for them, and they felt that if he died that he would go to heaven. And they pointed out that this war just goes on, and that sometime it has to end, and it's not going to end without the Taliban sharing power because they control large areas in Afghanistan. And so the reality is that we have to come to terms with the way things are, not the way we would wish that they would be.
Jay.
Well, I think certainly the wars are a huge expense, and this is the only time in U.S. history where we've gone to war and not raised taxes in order to pay for it. So part of the two wars, I mean, part of this huge deficit that we're dealing with is also essentially war spending. I mean, all of those war bills, you know, the supplemental war spending bills were done, you know, on deficit spending, and that's, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars worth of it in the last 8-9 years. So certainly ending the wars will help save money, will help, you know, bring down those costs, and will also hopefully end up helping bring down the deficit, as well as, you know, as well as obviously, and, you know, not risking human American lives anymore. But, yeah, it's, you know, it's a big problem.
What is the Afghanistan review? There's supposed to be something taking place on that this week in Congress, Jay?
Well, I think the review is expected out soon. It's been done for months, my understanding is, and there as always, when the Defense Reauthorization Bill comes up, which it actually failed to come up last week, so I don't think that they're going to be taking it up again this week. Although they're going to try and separate out, don't ask, don't tell, and they're going to make another attempt at that later this week in the Senate. But whenever the Defense Reauthorization Act comes up, you always get sort of moves to by Dennis Kucinich or by Russ Feingold to put in timelines for withdrawals from Iraq, Afghanistan now from Afghanistan these days, and there. There is a sense, I think, now that the timeline will be sort of by 2014. You're going to see most troops coming out starting in 2011. But a lot of this is pretty controversial. I mean, I think Petraeus doesn't like the idea of General Petraeus, who's in charge of Afghanistan, doesn't like the idea of starting to withdraw troops so soon as next year. There's a lot more work that needs to be done, and the Afghani security forces just aren't capable of securing their own country at this point. So it's a lot of tough choices to be made.
You got to ask, how long does it take? How long does it take? This has gone on for years.
It does, but keep in mind that the Afghan war was pretty neglected for many years. So while we did start the war in 2002, I mean, we weren't really fighting it in earnest when so many resources were being diverted to Iraq. So, I mean, it's only been the last couple of years that the attention has turned back to Afghanistan, and a really good faith effort has been made into stabilizing that country and into bringing an end to that war. But it's difficult, especially when, you know, the goodwill of the Afghan people has been squandered. You know, when we first came in, they were much more excited about seeing American troops there. Really saw it as a sign of hope that their country was going to get turned around. And because we spent such a long time not doing much there, they've lost a lot of hope and a lot of support because they feel that, you know, there's been a lot of civilian lives that have been lost, and they just feel that there hasn't been enough progress made.
Thanks, June, for the call. Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Another great program. Wonderful guest. A couple weeks ago, when you interviewed Richard Wolff, talking about all the infighting and his book about all the infighting and within the administration, it was prior to Obama cutting the deal with the Republicans on the tax measure. But subsequent to that announcement, I heard him being questioned about it. And he had what I thought was a pretty interesting observation, and I'd like to get Jay's opinion on this. He said that the Republicans, and particularly the Senate Republicans, have been so phenomenally successful in being the party of no based on the fact that Obama is out of the mainstream, way too far left, dare we say socialist, and therefore they are standing like stalwarts, blocking everything and saving the Republic, I suppose. And he said that what in this making this move Obama has done is effectively undercut that position, because all of a sudden it's like, well, if I'm all that out of the mainstream, how come you just made a deal with me? And that and Wolf's opinion is that Obama will now be able to use this as a tool to, lessen that stream of attack. What do you think of that?
Well, certainly it's striking that Mitch McConnell, who's the Senate minority leader, the top Republican in the Senate, is negotiating, frankly. This is, I think, the first time he's actually sort of really negotiated in earnest with the administration. To be fair, this is a two-way street, and the administration also wasn't very interested in negotiating with Mitch McConnell up until this point. They chose to do health care alone, and there was a point in the middle of the health care negotiations when Olympia Snowe was the one Republican who voted in committee, in the Senate Finance Committee, for health care reform. And there was talk of negotiating with her and with Susan Collins and with some of the other Republican moderates. And the Democrats in the Senate and in the White House decided at that moment, we're not going to negotiate with Republicans. We're going to make one more attempt at the public option, and we're just going to cut it off there. We're just not going to negotiate. And so there has been, it has to be a two-way street. You have to talk on both sides. You have to sort of be given the opportunity to negotiate and also be willing to negotiate. And yes, absolutely, Mitch McConnell has been very successful in opposing much of the president's agenda, in fact, nearly bringing down a good portion of the president's agenda. There's been a record number of motions for cloture filed, which, essentially are filibusters, and really things that just are everyday pedestrian things like, a motion to proceed with, for unanimous consent for something that's incredibly bipartisan. I'm trying to think of an example of this, but for example, the food safety bill, which has been hung up for years in the Senate, I mean, that got filibustered. I mean, things that are sort of everybody supports and passed the Senate by 99 votes, they're being filibustered just for the sake of slow walking legislation, for slowing everything down and for blocking things. And that this sort of atmosphere has been increasingly acrimonious, and it doesn't lend itself to the kind of old school negotiations, the old school compromises that you used to see with the lions of the Senate, like Teddy Kennedy, John Warner on the Republican side, Pete Domenici. I mean, these guys used to always put legislating and then legislation above the sort of partisan rancor, and that's an art form that's being lost in the Senate right now, and it doesn't really exist anymore.
Scott, I'm interested in your thoughts about the tax cut. What do you think?
I guess I'm like so many other people in that, when Bernie Sanders made that statement on the floor, not to sound too, gushingly partisan on it, I thought, really, how much do you really need? It's kind of,
Is enough?
Did you happen to see Jerry Jones last night on 60 Minutes talking about he's worth, $2 billion?
Yes, I did.
Thinking he could lose it all.
Right.
I'm thinking, boy, if I had the money that these people have, I don't think I'd really be that worried about losing it all. You know, I'm kind of with Bill Gates' dad on this. You know, let's pay our share, and you know, and frankly, not being one of those folks, I think we need to pay for what, you know, I think we need to pay for government. Mm. I really do. And I think it's sad, I guess, that we, you know, we want so much and yet we think we're taxed to death. I don't buy it.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you so much.
More phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 13th of December. And our guest is J. Newton Small, congressional correspondent for Time Magazine and the author of the cover story of this week's Time Magazine, which happens to be a picture of Sarah Palin. And the story is an interesting one on Sarah Palin. It is titled Palin in Progress. Does she want to be president or just rich and famous? We have a couple lines open for the first time. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More phone calls. And let's go to Ann from Madison. Hi, Ann.
Hi, I had a couple of comments. First, this doesn't cover the people whose Social Security benefits have already maxed out. So they're still out in the cold, and believe me, it is very cold.
Unemployment, you mean? Unemployment benefits.
Yeah, and then Social Security, I believe the destruction of Social Security or the privatizing of Social Security so that the Wall Street and corporate CEO crowd can get their hands on it and force people to invest is the whole point of this. Because when you lower the FICA contribution on people's paychecks, even by 2%, you know, that's just the first step. That will reduce the base that's available for Social Security, which is the most successful program most countries have. You know, every enlightened country has a system like Social Security. And the United States, under the grand leadership of supply-siders and greedy, I'm going to say pigs, like Mitch McConnell, with the acquiescence of the Democrats, are trying to destroy this wonderful system that keeps people out of poverty. And third, Senator Bernie Sanders filibustered all by his lonesome on Friday for hours against this cave-in and this extra perks for the obscenely rich. And not one, maybe one, two, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana for a little while and Sherrod Brown of Ohio for a short period. All the rest of the senators were off at their, I don't know where they were, at their parties. The Democrats didn't give Sanders any support at all. So they say one thing, and their weakness, Harry Reid's utter capitulation, you know, in exchange for, I'm sure, plenty of favors from the super rich, is the problem here. We know what the Republicans are like, but the Democrats have not stood up for the people and their public servants. This is why they weren't reelected in such huge numbers.
Thank you, Ann, for the call. Jay.
Well, certainly, I think the message has not gotten through that, of the election, I would say, has not gotten through. You could take the message both ways. One is that they're not being partisan enough, and the other is that they perhaps have been too partisan. And I'm not sure, you know, I guess it depends on what side of the spectrum that you're coming from. A lot of Democratic advisors or, you know, I guess you could say spin doctors or people who specialize in elections have said that the meaning of this last election is that the Democrats were too hyperpartisan in the last 2 years passed too much legislation that was sort of on their own backs and not shared responsibility with the Republicans, and that's why they lost office. I don't know, you know, if going farther to the left is going to help maintain or reach it back out to the center, to the independence that they lost in this last election.
Don't you think the message really was that the Democrats were not successful in helping people in their daily lives? They weren't successful in creating jobs. They weren't successful in helping people feel as though they had, you know, a secure future. People are hurting.
Absolutely. And I mean, part of the problem is that much of the legislation that they passed, I mean, for example, the stimulus, it prevented pain. It didn't sort of help me. It didn't it didn't. I'm trying to, it was more of a preventative than a proactive bill, if is what I'm trying to say. And so it saved millions of jobs, most economists will say. But if your job was saved by the stimulus, you probably didn't know it. And you probably, you know, don't realize that this is what was at stake here and what was acting. So the fact that things weren't worse didn't make the fact that, you know, they weren't better. I mean, things have not gotten better. And so that didn't help them with votes. And the health care bill, most of it doesn't come into act into force until 2014. So a lot of people most people aren't feeling the effects of that bill yet. And financial re-regulation, I mean, that was really just about tightening rules around Wall Street. It's not something that's going to be felt very much on Main Street. So
mm-hmm.
All of their big ticket items, while in the most impressive legislative season since LBJ, really haven't helped it. People haven't felt their impact yet, and that's what's causing a lot of the pain at the polls right now.
Yeah. Thanks, Anne, for the call. Cindy on the road. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Hey, I have a question about, isn't it a conflict of interest for some of these people to be voting on such a tax break for that would actually help them out? And my second question is, what if they let them expire? We have a deficit, and then wouldn't that help our deficit and get us out of this trouble? Because we got these tax breaks when we're going to war, and all of a sudden we get these tax breaks. And I remember listening to my grandparents and everything like that, where they had to sacrifice when they went to war, World War I and World War II. I mean, wouldn't that help? I'll take my comments off.
Thanks, Cindy.
Certainly, there's. In the long run, taxes will need to be raised. There's no question. Just beyond paying for the wars, the deficits are just massive. Bailing out half of the economy has been very expensive. And so there absolutely is going to need to be tax hikes coming up. But right now, most economists will tell you if you do tax hikes at this current moment, given the fragile state of the recovery, that could really kill the recovery and throw us back into a double-dip recession. Well, in the long run, absolutely, for deficits, you're going to need to raise taxes. Right now, it's not a good idea.
Could you go back to Don't Ask, Don't Tell? What's happening with that this week?
Sure. As you may or may not know, there was a vote in the last week to bring up the Defense Reauthorization Bill, which the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell is already written into that bill. That failed by a vote of, I think, 57 to 43. And so they now there's a plan to essentially not bring it up on the back of this sort of giant reauthorizing bill, strip it out and make it a standalone bill and just sort of try and pass it that way. And I don't know that they have the votes to do it. I think most experts in Washington think they don't, but they're going to make an attempt to do it anyway because this is the last best shot that they'll have for years, probably going into the next Congress. There won't be the votes to do it because the Republicans will have increased minority in the Senate and a majority in the House. So less sort of a last-ditch Hail Mary effort to pass Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Amy in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment about Sarah Palin. It seems that she may be playing all of us. She's keeping alive this question of whether she is going to run for president by not answering the question. And so it piques interest in her, and it keeps the media trying to figure out the answer to the question. And she just keeps stringing people along. So she's going to be out there in the spotlight for as long as she can do that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you're right. This is a part of a bit of a tease. You know, she's showing just enough leg to keep us very interested, but she's not giving away her hand. That's, you know, part of the process of running for president. And, you know, there are other candidates out there right now who are going through a similar process who we don't really care about or have paid much less attention to. And so it's not just the fact that she's, you know, flirting with a run for president, but it's also it's also the fact of who she is and her sort of celebrity and her Sarah Palin Inc., the whole sort of package that goes around her.
What do you think of her, Amy?
Well, I think that she's more of a media phenomenon. I just don't think that she has much depth when it comes to knowledge about a lot of very important things. And I personally disagree with her politically.
She certainly knows how to stay in front of that camera, doesn't she?
Well, she's very good at that.
Yes, she is. She's really good at that. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye. Jackie in Appleton. Hi.
Hi. She didn't answer the question Ann asked about Social Security, which I think is why the Republicans are so excited about this bill, because this is a first step to destroying or privatizing Social Security.
I think most Democrats will tell you that that they're stalwart champions of Social Security, and that they would not allow the system to be dismantled. That they this is the same Congress pretty much that blocked Bush's attempts at privatizing parts of Social Security, and I think Pelosi especially it's one of her sort of champion platforms. Programs that she most champions out there. So I don't know that a year-long or two-year-long payroll holiday of 2% of the money that goes into Social Security will definitely down the road mean that private accounts for Social Security at all. I think that it's just this is a way of getting more money back into people's pockets. That the Social Security Trust Fund isn't going off the cliff in the immediate future. It'll be at least a decade before that happens. And the government feels, or the president feels, and the Republicans feel that that this is something they can afford to do. It's more important to get the economy back on its feet in the short term rather than worrying about the Social Security Trust Fund in the long term. But again, I don't think it's going to endanger it. I don't think it's going to be the thing that puts it over the edge. And I certainly think that if you ask any Democrat in Congress and the president, they are very much against privatizing Social Security.
Thanks, Jackie. Bill in Portage. Hi. Hello, Bill.
Hello. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Good. Two comments. Last week, both banks I'm dealing with on a small business loan raised the interest rates, and both had the same answer. With the tax bill that went through, nothing's being done to help the deficit. And second comment is Sarah Palin. I'm a strong Republican turning Democrat, and she just, I think the woman would do anything she possibly could to get into office. And I just don't have a lot of faith that once everybody starts seeing a little cuts affect each and every individual, I don't think they're going to be as enthused about them as what they are now. It's almost like really wanting something, but once you get it, it's not that great. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Bill.
I think Palin is, there's this sort of aspect, I think, of politicians in America that I find really interesting, and that is I'm told that, and I found this to be true in covering both congressional and presidential races, that the people elect they're members of Congress because they want a pit bull in Washington. They want somebody who will fight for them. They want somebody who will bring home the bacon. They want somebody who will represent their state or their district with everything that they have. But for presidents, people seem to really, they want somebody they like. They want somebody that they could watch on TV every day or a couple times a week for years and not get sick of them. And it comes down to sort of the beer test, or they want somebody who they can sit down and have a beer with. And that is an important factor as much as any other factor of intelligence or being prepared for office as much as anything, I think. And to the degree that Sarah Palin has that, she's, she definitely does have that sort of factor of, like, I'd like to sit down and have a beer with her. Where she needs to work on and what she needs to bone up on is the other stuff. Is she experienced enough? Is she, can she lead the country? Can she be a commander-in-chief? And I think that's her challenge, to convince voters like you that she's capable of this.
Thanks, Bill. Paul in Duluth. Hi.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I want to throw my hat up in the air again for Bernie Sanders. He's come up a few times. I couldn't watch his entire presentation, but he didn't just stand there and read the phone book. He actually kept to the topic for eight and a half hours. My question is, since the guest is from Time Magazine, I'm thinking about who's going to be the person of the year, and I'm kind of thinking from a couple of different points, but I thought about the Chilean miners because that was such a story
that's interesting
that ended so well, but I'd also throw my hat up again for Bernie.
I don't think Bernie's going to make it, but it's an interesting vote. The Chilean miners, and you said part of the article asked the question is why Sarah Palin could be in the running for this.
I'm not involved in the Person of the Year deliberations. Those are done in New York, and I'm in Washington, so I don't know who it is. But I think certainly, the Tea Party is a fascinating movement. I think that we don't necessarily do single people. We do things like that. I think that might be interesting. The Chilean miners, as you said, are perhaps the most hopeful and joyous of the year. Moment and people of the year, and that's always a nice thing to reflect. I don't know. I'm hoping that it just won't be Putin again, because that was pretty controversial.
Probably not. I don't think he's in the running this year. Thank you very much, Paul, for your call. Jay, thanks so much for being with us this hour. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you for having me on.
Our guest this hour, Jay Newton Small, congressional correspondent for Time Magazine. She covered President Obama's campaign and win for the presidency, and she's been covering the very active and in many ways controversial Congress. A lot going on today in the Senate, and we never even got to the nuclear arms treaty and don't ask, don't tell, et cetera. So we thank her for being with us. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. And thanks, everybody, for all of your lively calls. I want to remind you that we're doing comedy on Thursday of this week at 10 o'clock. So if you've had enough of politics and serious topics, we're going to chuckle on Thursday at 10. That's the story here. We'll have news coming up in a moment and another interesting hour coming up ahead. What cities in the world are really flourishing and why?